listen, think, learn, grow. Listen, think, learn, grow. Live.
This is the Spirit of Life Metaphysics Radio Program, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Michael Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening and welcome to the Spirit of Life program for Wednesday, July 12th. My name is Michael Kelly. I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Oh, good evening, Michael. I am really glad to be here, and especially tonight we have Dr. Mike on.
Absolutely. Very much looking forward to that discussion. And I got to say thank you to everybody joining us live. I appreciate you coming back and joining us. I know we were off last week. I was schlepping around the country doing a few things here and there, but so happy to have you joining us again. And thanks to those that catch up with us in the live in the archives. Spirit of Life is a weekly service and educational program of the International Church of Metaphysical Humanism. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as explore science and spirituality. In addition to this broadcast, ICMH offers other educational programs that can be found at metaphysicsinstitute.org and tfuniversity.org. Now, like I said, very much looking forward to tonight's discussion, but before we start, we're going to, of course, begin with our 9 abbreviated principles of belief. Those are: 1, do no harm, do right. 2, we believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3, we believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems. 4, we are all equal. One planet, one race, one ancestry, one destiny. 5, we recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6, we are physical and spiritual beings. Consciousness survives death of the physical body. 7, self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will create self-completeness. 8. Metaphysical education and practical life skills empower the human spirit and enhance the human condition. And 9. Expanding human consciousness leads to human evolution and peaceful coexistence. So tonight, we are very much looking forward to this and want to just welcome Dr. Mike. Welcome to the program again.
Thank you. Glad to be back here.
I don't even know where to start. I have so many things I want to cover. But congratulations on your retirement.
Yep.
Congratulations on your 50th, hear me everybody, 50th wedding anniversary. So these
Absolutely.
Are milestones for you. Great, great milestones.
Yeah, well, you know, it's downhill from here.
But it could be the funnest part.
Have you been enjoying your retirement? Let's start there, Mike.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, I haven't really done anything major. It's just a lot of little things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like I threw my alarm clock away.
Good.
And I just, you know, kind of whatever happens to, pop up, I do.
Do you feel it's kind of really a couple of months in? It's a decompression time, do you think?
Yeah, that's like I said, I don't really have anything planned for, you know, a while. It's just a matter of do nothing or do whatever I want.
Oh, that's
you know, so
nice.
It's kind of like I work in the yard a little bit. I work on my car a little bit. Little things here and there.
I might argue that being able to just do nothing is a little essential to the art of exploring our inner selves and kind of increasing our awareness. Sometimes we just need to sit and have a little of the mundane. Makes me think of some examples where some great figures had their aha moments when they were doing something, you know, mundane with their minds. And, Albert Einstein working in the patent office, you know, for a prime example. That is really important, just to be able to sit there and think about things.
Oh, I just want to mention something. I don't know anybody around Tampa.
Yeah, that's where I am.
Weekend,
yeah, that's where I'm at.
Weekend, Shark Con is going on.
Oh.
And Shark Con, it was off for a couple of years because of COVID, but I used to go to it all the time. And it's at the fairgrounds in Tampa.
Okay.
It's 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. And they usually have a lot of, interesting things. And they have some pretty well-known people show up and stuff like that. So I don't know if anybody's around Tampa or not, but it's going on Saturday and Sunday.
And so important stuff, too. I think sharks often get a bad rap.
It's basically for the preservation of sharks, basically. Huh. And that's, it's a lot of, there's a lot of vendors and different things like that. Yeah. But primarily the whole idea is educate people with some shark information and ecology and things like that.
Well, you know, sounds interesting for shark people.
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty big deal. Yeah.
And sharks are such an ancient species that, have changed a little over time.
Yeah.
Aren't the sharks among the oldest that they can measure?
They're up around the alligator.
Wow.
They've been around for a long time. Of course, the big predecessor to sharks, in particular the white shark, is the megalodon.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever seen some megalodon teeth, but they're the biggest one they have found was, I think it was 7.25 inches long, which would make the shark, based on, based on a white shark anatomy, somewhere around 60 feet.
Mm. That's big.
So a 6 foot person would be a mere morsel.
Quick
that
bite.
Wouldn't even be a snack.
Yeah. It wouldn't be much of a bite, but it's they've been supposedly extinct for probably, I think, about 100 billion years, something like that.
Oh, thank God. I mean, so I know they found that live one to do the Hollywood movie.
Do what?
They found that live one to do the movie, of course.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah, they hunted high and low for that guy.
Oh, yeah.
But, it's megalodons are...
Well, now this is a good segue into marine life behaviors. I mentioned in previous programs, I wanted to ask you about orcas and those behaviors. But now there's also some behaviors in orcas off Hawaii that I read about. What's your take on this?
Orcas in general are extremely intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like, in particular, what you're referring to are the orcas around the Mediterranean and Straits of Gibraltar and things like that.
Well, and there's now a recorded case just off of England, near mm-hmm. Scotland.
And orcas are, they have regional dialects. They're mm-hmm. They're all over the world, but they're segregated into small populations.
Yeah, they have, communities.
And, yeah, and it's like, and it's a very well-organized community. But they have, each community, believe it or not, has their own dialect.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. In other words, all the clicks and whistles that you hear, they are different depending on where you're at. And it's kind of like a lot of people don't realize that it's a cultural evolution
mm-hmm.
is what you're looking at. And the whole idea of what the idea behind you know, these attacks are basically they believe that it originally started with one matriarch, because pods are made up of they're ruled by the female, the matriarch of the. So once they get past the years of giving birth, they become the leader of the pod. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of this stuff, they're so well organized, is because of the knowledge that the matriarchs have had. You know, they lived for like 80 years.
You know, I love this. I often think it's so fascinating, the parallels that you see between the Orca and humanity, really. They have complex societies. They have dialects, almost mm-hmm. almost a language. They form in complex units. You know, I think a lot of people have seen the video online of how they work together to get a seal off of a sheet of ice. And, you know, they have long lives, and they're very smart. You know,
absolutely.
I think we often don't give these creatures the agency that they deserve.
Well, the whole thing with the orcas in the Gibraltar area and so forth, they believe that it was led by a single female orca. Its actually name is White Gladys.
Oh.
And they're not really absolutely sure what the motivation is, but there are two basic ideas. Is that sometime she experienced bad with a boat or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And as a result, she basically has taught the other members of the pod to strike out against these boats, and they basically bite
the propeller.
No, they don't bite that. They'll get
the rudder. I think of what sticks into the water.
Yeah, what they steer with. As you can tell, I'm not a sailor, so and so it's kind of a learn type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ideas is that it's because of some bad experience they've had in the past. Okay. There's another one that says, well, they do it because they thought that it was a predator, and it happens to be around the time of the bluefin tuna run. And as a result, they may have thought that the boat was another predator. That's another thought.
Well, I'm more in line with the notion that, because I had read that one of the theories is, I didn't know about the matriarch angle of it, but that one of them may have been injured, and this is a retaliation or some kind of a protection mode. But I find it fascinating that they know where to strike on the boats to disable them.
Yeah, it's primarily that's what they do. They don't. There has been not to my knowledge, no humans that have been killed by orcas. Now, here's a funny thing. They call them killer whales. Well, they're not. They're a member of the dolphin family. They happen to be the largest dolphin.
Yeah, I think they have a lot of similarities to the bottlenose, don't they?
Oh yeah, yeah, and. You know, it's kind of one of those things where I never have looked up where in the world did they get the name killer whale? Don't know.
But, the etymology of that. With their teeth, they kind of have a predatory look to them. I always suspected that might be it. But, you know, they definitely have a reputation in the ocean. I know that the great white shark will avoid them because they terrified them.
Matter of fact, in South Africa, killer whales eat white sharks.
I didn't know that.
Yep, they do.
So as far as I'm aware, they're the apex predator in their environment.
Pretty much. Yeah.
So what other, I know that orcas group hunt. What other marine species group hunts?
Well, all your dolphins do.
Mm.
I mean, they're all the same family.
I've recently read an article about humpback whales and how they'll operate in pods and groups. And the point of this article was in how they absolutely hate orcas. They will get in between them and the prey.
They go after the babies.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a pod of orcas, and they'll basically wear them out until the baby gets separated, then they attack it, kill it. And about the only thing they eat are the livers.
Really?
Yeah, that's very, very high in all the essentials that they need.
You know, it's just to stop there for a second. When I lived on a farm raising animals for over 20 years, and I had an encounter with an owl that I had caged up my ducks. I'll tell you, all of my I had netting on the top, netting on the sides, but I'd still go in there, and here's this owl, and they only eat the brains.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. They don't eat the rest of the bird; they just eat the brains. So when you say they just eat the liver, I'm saying
that's primarily what they do. Yeah.
How do they know that?
Just learn behavior.
Yeah, wow. I think probably a good portion of instinctual knowledge too. Which,
well, here's another little tidbit. You know, when people talk about intelligent animals, the first ones they immediately think of are things like chimpanzees, bottlenose dolphins, and so forth. But in reality, the orcas really have them both beat.
Really?
Yep.
I've always thought to myself, based on some of the things I've watched and read, that if I were to say that any other species on Earth approached sentience, it might be the orca.
Well, yeah. I think when you're talking language, I have a question, Dr. Mike. Of all the different, let's say, linguistics that orcas have in their pods and locations, is there a universal one also that they share?
Not really, but here's something that they do. They imitate other. They'll imitate dolphins, for example.
Huh.
They'll imitate. Actually, I've read some articles that saying they were found to imitate sea lions.
Hmm. Maybe for hunting. I know that's kind of their favorite.
So there is no, I mean, I say there is no universal language. I mean, I know that, you know, like I said before, orcas, you know, have a regional dialect. And do they transcend other regional, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
It would make sense that they, to me, they kind of do. And a good reason for that is that you're talking about how orcas are starting to act strange in Hawaii. And there's basically the assumption is that an orca from a pod that has picked up a particular trait migrates and winds up in a different pod. And then they wind up teaching that pod, you know, and so forth. So, you know, there's some mixing and stuff that goes on between different geographical pods. And
so what would cause one orca to leave a pod and go to another pod?
I couldn't answer that. Think... All I know is that there is no such thing as a lone orca.
Wow.
They're always in pods.
Which is one of the other reasons that I have a hard time with places like SeaWorld and the like.
Yeah, well, not that, you know,
not that people that work there are bad or anything like that.
No,
I don't want
to
say that at all.
One of my best friends in San Diego wound up being the vice president of SeaWorld, and he was the one personally that collected most of the orcas at SeaWorld Of course, this is back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Taking them out of their environment is probably not good, but they were treated better than most humans.
Oh, no doubt about that.
And you know, they cared about them a lot. A funny thing about captivity is if you go and you actually, if at any time you actually saw one, you'll notice that in captivity, their dorsal fin is hooked over. It's like slumping. It's like depression.
Yeah. Oh.
And in the wild, they're not. They're, you know, straight vertical. And so they're not, you know, even, I don't know of any studies or anything about why that is. But to me, it's always been a sign that, you know, there's something not quite right.
So do you go with the theory that likely this behavior of messing up boats is taught from a matriarch? Do you think that that's the more accurate?
I think that's possible. Or one of the other crazy ideas I read was that it's kind of like, well, kids will be kids.
Oh.
You know, so one of them saw something and they decided that all, you know, chip in and do that. But I'm more of the idea that I think the matriarch has passed down this to the pod, and then in one pod it's passed to another pod somehow.
So claiming that this can potentially hurt us, so get it first.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And you know, I mean, it could be a seasonal thing.
Oh.
I mean, it's like.
How do you mean seasonal?
Well, let me think here.
It made me think of a campaign season that humans would have in their warfare.
Yeah, they've had some strange seasonal things happen with, like, dolphin, for example. And they have found, like up in the Puget Sound, there was one that why they did it, I don't know. They would put a salmon on their nose, you know, and they would keep it there for, you know, a long time. And other dolphins picked it up, started doing it. And they couldn't figure out why. And it was just, you know, that particular season. And afterwards, they never did it again. So, you know, why'd they do that?
I have tended to attribute a lot of these things to boredom. If they're as intelligent as we think,
yeah,
true, you get bored and you just want to do stuff.
You know, I think why this is, I know everybody might be saying, okay, we're a metaphysical university and so on, we, you know, approach metaphysics. To me, this is, it indicates consciousness and the levels of intelligence and consciousness. And you know, the sea is filled with things we don't know about yet. Yeah, well, nobody's discovered.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, you want to talk about the strangest critter on Earth, talk about an octopus.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There are actually individuals out there who are convinced that the DNA from an octopus came in on, you know, a comet or something like that, simply because they're extreme. I mean, they're high intelligence.
Yeah.
And just there's a whole they recognize themselves. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there's a whole line of stuff. But yeah, if there was going to be an alien, an octopus
look the part.
Would be a good start.
And they have, you know, thinking about, you know, biology and animals, you know, it's the quest of studying awareness itself, which is metaphysics. But it makes me think about the octopus in this case. If my memory serves, they have multiple brains. Or something along those lines?
Yeah, they have three.
So, I mean, Talk about a perfect example for the mind being detached from the physical brain.
I'm gobsmacked at the moment because I'm now thinking of a number of other, because that's what I like to do too, is research things. When I see something in an article and they go, what's that? You know, it's like now they have determined that bees can actually feel pain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you want to hear another good one? There's a group in England who are petitioning people to not serve lobster because they feel pain.
Well, it's hard to imagine something being put into a boiling pot alive and not feeling something.
Yeah.
I think we talk about things like this because it soothes the, you know, conscience, but yeah. Yeah, I would not be surprised at all.
But wouldn't everything feel pain? I guess, look, I'm just saying here, you know, as Dr. Douglas Kelly would say, we live on a planet where everything eats everything. And I know Wendy just says, yeah. I mean, doesn't everything feel pain?
Great minds think alike.
Well, I mean, that's a good question.
A higher consciousness.
I think,
you know, yeah. Like, for example, fish feel pain.
Hmm. I've always tended to think, and, you know, shout me down if I'm wrong, but I've always thought that a higher level of intelligence allows you to experience pain in a more visceral way on an emotional level in addition to the physical one.
That could very well be.
I think anything that can plot and plan and adapt has levels of consciousness, you know, that I think that as humans, we tend to think of consciousness in a very subjective way, mm-hmm. like we're so special.
Yeah, well, but we're not.
No, and we're not. So when we look at measures of consciousness and we really look at behaviors from a more objective way, if that's possible, mm-hmm. you know, trees talk to trees, protect the, you know, the little saplings.
Well, actually, trees have, plants have emotions.
Exactly.
And that's been proven scientifically.
So if we want to say, oh, everybody don't eat animals because, you know, go vegan, yeah. The plants feel that too.
Yeah,
so,
don't eat broccoli, right? Okay.
Well, there's multiple. Actually, I've always liked broccoli. I was going to jump on the bandwagon of broccoli being gross, but I like it.
I found out today my dog loves cauliflower because I actually dropped some on the floor by accident, and he didn't have a problem.
Wow. Oh, cauliflower dog.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of one of those things where I think the higher intelligence, I think the more they can relate, or not relate to, but I mean perceive things like pain.
Take
a spider has consciousness,
right?
If he didn't, he wouldn't know how to do a web. He wouldn't know how to, you know, capture insects. So when you squash a spider, do they feel anything?
Well, I mean, it depends on how quickly you do it, I imagine.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
But I mean,
think
it's kind of, you know, it's like anything. It's, you know, what is consciousness?
And I would say, pain, I think we've told ourselves, oh, we can step on ants or they don't feel pain and things like that. But pain is a very primal thing. It's a function. You know, it prevents you from further injury. And I think that anything that wants to avoid injury to itself and destruction of itself would feel pain as an evolutionary constant.
But if it feels pain, the equal and opposite must also be true to feel joy. Does that not make sense?
Well, I guess if you talk about a spider, I guess he enjoys eating his bug. But, I mean, I think joy is another one of those things that are, you know, it's like pain, love, joy, all that. Mm. Those are things that I think are interpreted as such with higher level of intelligence. And I think there's a whole lot of animals out there that have that.
Well, that would be my view also. However, do you think that there could be varying levels of consciousness? Here's what I think that, just my view, that the only thing that distinguishes human beings as being different from any other species is that we have dexterity and we can create fingers, toes, you know, and a mind that can kind of be nimble, and we've found ways to not just build fires, but build, huts.
We're more complex. Animals will create, beavers will create dams, and all kinds of things. Ants will create structures, but we are a more complex form of that. I totally agree.
Well, I think could it be possible, and just hear me out here, that an orca could be as intelligent as humans, although its physicality determines it to exist in a certain way. That's all.
Well, I think they could be very, very intelligent. You talk about humans. I mean, like, yeah, we've done a real bang up job protecting the planet, haven't we?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Compared to, things like orcas and octopi and, all those things like that, it's a little hard to kind of say, does one experience something more than another?
And awareness is such a hard thing to quantify to begin with, that how do you put a mathematical scientific figure on it?
Oh, I don't think you can.
I think it's emotional. Myself.
It's kind of a, it's one of those things where I think from the standpoint of pure science, I think they don't know.
Yeah.
One thing.
They also have a problem is a lot of them don't want to accept any other kind of explanation. And hence, that's why I think, from a metaphysical standpoint, I can understand it a little better than a pure materialist.
Yeah. And, there's one thing I did want to touch on. It's picking up steam in chat, too. Jerry in chat had pointed out that, she likes to say a thank you to the things that she's eating, consuming. And I think it's always wonderful to express gratitude. And she noted that it's something that comes from, Native Indigenous American culture, as well as other places in the world. But I think that's, and I too have done it. Audra's put in chat, she's done it, where you just kind of give thanks to the thing that you're eating because it gave its life so that you could continue on. I think that's kind of an understanding of life and the cycle of it.
When I was growing our own food, raising kids, and those birds ended up in the freezer, and that goat ended up in the freezer, and there was an appreciation for everything, and that's what I wanted to impart to my kids, is where things come from. This is where it comes from, and you appreciate what you have.
I've always had the opinion that if everybody would tour a slaughterhouse, you would never eat beef again.
That's true. That's why I don't eat meat from a slaughterhouse. I'm saying this sincerely. This is just me, everybody. I don't live on a farm anymore, so it's limited. But I always get from a local, if I can, a local butcher, local farmer, local everything. There is one particular butcher shop here that has ribs from Germany. And I go, what? You have ribs from Germany? No, thank you. So I will go and source out another butcher shop, ribs from here. And again, this whole global trade thing. And I understand the money and the power and all that, but I don't like it.
A couple things I wanted to point out. I do agree that there's a lot of ethical dilemmas in factory farming. Definitely not the direction I thought we were going to go, but great discussion. I think there's a problem with factory farming. But I also, in just terms of eating meat, I think we're all on the same page, but just pointing out that the ethical issues of, you know, decrying somebody's morality if they eat meat in certain places in the world is a luxury. You know, many places in the world have the abundance of, you know, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, to easily be vegetarian. Mm-hmm. Other places, the Eurasian steppe, for example, very hard to be a vegetarian.
There's a province in India that they don't have access to meat, so they found the equivalence of the nutrition. And you make sure that they put that together in their meals every day. So you're getting the proteins, you know, to make sure your enzymes continue to work. Because that's a biological thing. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can be vegetarian. No. And not everybody can be vegan.
Well, Homo sapien was meant to be a carnivore.
I agree.
I mean, that's just basically when you look at the overall dentition and things like that. Our teeth were meant to tear and grind.
Mm-hmm. And
I guess you can, you know, say it, you know, whether it's meat or carrots or whatever. I mean, that's fundamentally what they were meant to be.
Definitely omnivores, which has that aspect to it. We eat meat. That is kind of the natural way that we've been able to survive. And again, we have this separation between us and nature at this point where we can kind of, you know, pick and mm-hmm. choose if we want. But, you know, for many millennia, it was not a matter of ethics. It was a matter of survival.
Yeah, If you go back to, I remember my grandfather, he would, he was raised up back in the Dust Bowl area and stuff like that. I mean, it was like they didn't have a choice. I mean, you raised a goat for one reason and so forth like that. But, yeah, nowadays I think most people do their hunting and fishing in the market.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I fish a lot, and I'm strictly catch and release. I don't keep them. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, the less I like beef.
I'm with you. I think that, you know, I can't eat octopus. When I became aware of rubbery. The consciousness of an octopus,
squid are still stupid, right? They don't feel pain. Squid,
you know,
calamari, I can still eat that.
Squid are pretty smart, too.
Don't tell me. I don't want to go there because I really like calamari.
Yeah, well, to me, it's like chewing a rubber band.
Well, you fry anything, it's pretty good, but.
Yeah. Well, I used to eat, you know, abalone a lot. And the only way you can eat abalone is you slice it thin and pound it and, put a batter on it and deep fry it. I mean, those. But,
you know, a good segue into, because here's, you know, time just flies when we're talking to you, Dr. Mike. When you talk about spiders, if there would be such a thing as close to alien, octopus, I was just reading in the chat, my brain kind of folded. I want to talk about the incident. I know everybody, I'm changing lanes. In Las Vegas, beginning of May.
Okay.
Because we can talk about this all night for hours. And because I find it all fascinating. So everyone, for those who don't know, there was an incident in Las Vegas where apparently the word is some kind of craft crashed. People claimed two aliens were in their backyard. Apparently, allegedly, there is some footage of this.
Okay.
Police say they couldn't release that footage because it was on private property, but the footage came out elsewhere through private means.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know your take on this.
Yeah, okay. I looked in that a little bit.
Good.
Video was deemed a hoax.
Okay.
The people that they interviewed partly on that stuff, you can hear them laughing and giggling and carrying on. So that's a big tip off right there that it was a hoax. It's like, you know, what they want, their 15 seconds of fame.
Yeah.
But the most important thing to me is the fact it was never reported to MUFON. So if it's not reported to MUFON, I classify it as a hoax.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. That's why I wanted to bring this up with you, because there was so much, you know, press given to this, like through social media. And I thought, there's something got to be a little bit suspicious about this, but I didn't put my finger on it that, not reported to MUFON.
Yeah, that's the big point, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that if it was a real experience,
yeah,
it would have been reported to MUFON.
Or the MUFON video, would have been there in a heartbeat to say, let's investigate. There,
it would have been analyzed. Well, it was analyzed by other folks and deemed to be a hoax.
And it's so easy to do these days, especially with generative AI.
Yeah, but you can still tell. There are ways when you look at them, you look at the pixelations and different things like that, and you can tell if it's it's been changed or whatever. But yeah, I know the video was deemed a hoax.
Okay. You know, something else that's made me a little bit mental these days is, how do we isolate what could be a potential UAP, you know, or UFO, when Starlink has 4,400 satellites out there? That's just Starlinks.
Yeah, and
now are complaining that it's causing so much, you know, EMFs, like the radiation, that it's interfering in how they view the skies. And Starlink's plans to put up a few more thousand in the next few years. And I'm thinking, we are polluting the sky. How do we know what's what?
Well, they actually have... Basically, they know where every object is, satellite-wise, where they are and everything like that. You can actually, there's a software package you can go to, and you can look up where your location is, and at any given time, it'll tell you what satellites are going over and so forth like that. That's one of the tools that they use to determine if you saw a UAP, UFO, or not, is, you know, you can tell an aircraft because they have a blinking, you know, landing lights and things like that. UFO, on the other hand, doesn't. It could be very erratic, and it's moving in a fashion that is not normal, and you have to look at it from the standpoint, if a person was inside, they would be a grease spot on the wall because of the G-forces of doing, you know, right-hand turns and at high speed and things like that. That is one of the criteria for our UAP is it erratic and so forth. If it's constant, just constant, going across the sky, it's more than likely a satellite.
Or a drone?
Could be a drone. But then again, drones have lights.
Yeah. More man-made.
Depending on, you know, what they're doing with it. But yeah, I mean, drones could be very easily interpreted as a UAP.
There has also been, I've noted on social media, some new crop circles.
Oh, really?
Up.
I haven't heard that.
There's a few new ones, of course, in England. You know, it's a real popular kind of place. But in other parts of the world, and they are a little different from, as I recall, because I like to follow, you know, a little bit of the designs and how I see crop circles as a language, in a way. And some of them could be fake, everybody, no question. But I go back to, you know, again, everybody, just to keep in reference here, I'm going to be 68 this year. So I go back to what I know of, even as a kid, stories back. 1967 was the first crop circle noted in Canada, right nearby where I lived. I visited the place, talked to the old timers of things that happened back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And there were no drones back then. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely, take the credibility of those stories to heart more than I take anything today.
Well, you know, crop circles are one of those interesting things where, yeah, you have a lot of them that were made by people.
Makes me think about the bell curve of probability. You know, a lot of hoaxes and it's a truth.
But there are the ones that they can't explain. And when you actually analyze them, they go in and look at them. And the way that the crop is turned over, they can only explain by energy at a particular joint, radiation, and some things like that. I mean, it's a person can't do that. Mm. So the question is, well, what did? Mm. So, yeah, there are a lot of unexplained crop circles out there. Now, I've never seen one and so forth like that, so I can't really tell you. But there's too many coincidences.
Yeah.
They're real. And I've never seen one, but I fully believe that, yeah, they're out there.
Well, a number of years ago, I talked to an old timer. I lived on a little acreage, and it was only about 5 miles from where this first crop circle was noted. And the old timer actually took me there, and he told me everything that happened that day, of how the cows started acting odd, and how they started kind of stampeding to one end of the thing, and the farm, the owner of these cattle, what's going on. And, you know, so this step by step, the government came out, the military came out, nobody could figure out, but there was this massive crop circle. Mm-hmm. And then it was gone. Now, he himself had seen many UFOs, but they were all quiet about it. The farmers would be quiet. He'd seen a cylinder across the sky. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the craziest one was when his wife and daughter had been out kind of in the field, and one of the orbs, this big metal orb, was kind of hovering above the ground. Well, they ran in the house. He came out, and it was hovering at the end of the driveway and zipping here, zipping there, and then zipped off. And, of course, they all had big panic attacks. And it fascinating to hear, like, he was about 80, 15 years ago when I talked to him. And he's, again, passed by now. But it's the stories he had to tell in that area. Now, by the ley lines, where this was in Alberta, just north of vortexes that are claimed to be as powerful as Sedona, Arizona.
Oh, yeah. There's do you watch on History Channel the Skinwalker Ranch series?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Keeping an eye on that.
There's
one.
Another
Very
one.
Interesting.
There's another one right after that. That it's a continuation, but what they're doing is they're going out to other sites across the country. And one of the sites is a ranch in Sedona.
Hmm.
And it's pretty interesting.
Well, I'll tell you, one of my favorite places is Sedona. Now, if Dr. Norm is listening and checking in, I would like to wish him a happy 90th birthday this year.
Oh, yeah.
He's written to me recently an email. As everybody might know, I have a daughter who's been living in Sedona for about 15 years.
Oh.
And I've been there many times. And he had asked, you know, what are the places to see, you know, and so on. Because that's his treat to himself this year, is to go visit Sedona. And so I mentioned I sent him links to all the vortexes to see and which ones I liked the best. Of course, Bell Rock is my favorite, the good balancing one. And you know, probably an Airbnb is best and so on. And so a shout out to Dr. Norm. He's been with IMHS for quite a long time now. And happy birthday. But
absolutely. Happy birthday to Dr. Norm.
Yeah. You know, in that kind of a journey, if anybody is ever interested in taking a little, you know, vision quest or sojourn, as they say, of visiting a place, because there are many, it's not just Sedona, there are many places throughout North America, you don't have to go far, where there are pyramids,
oh, yeah,
there are vortexes.
Uh-huh.
What's near you, Dr. Mike?
Oh, there are a lot of Native American sites, you know, within Texas itself. And you've got partly from the migration of, I think it was the Mayans or Incas, I can't remember which one, but they came up into the Southwest Texas, and they've got they found a lot of artifacts from that. Any really paranormal places that I really don't know.
Well, I think what is that show on Netflix now? Ancient Apocalypse.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It's so good because, I'm so bad with names these days. My brain just collapses in certain vessels. He's put together a series that really contradicts common theories about, you know, our evolution and how there are all these pyramids throughout North America. He's traveled the world.
Oh, yeah.
Geologist, anthropologist. I can't remember his name. I don't know why. But there are hints of the giants that walked throughout North America.
Yep.
There's all kinds of pyramids and sacred spots throughout North America, especially the U.S.
Well, the one I know of is the Serpent Mount.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it the history of what goes on, I think the history books really got it wrong.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they, you know, the Europeans were visiting, you know, Nova Scotia and all that up and like that, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, Graham Hancock. Thanks, Tabitha.
Hancock. Yeah.
I love that guy. I think he's awesome.
I'm trying to think of the guy's name.
See, I've been watching Oak Island for 10 years.
Oh, yeah, I have too.
I love it.
Have they found anything yet?
Of course, there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of, you know, how they edit and so on. But they're so close now. But the history they have learned about when Europeans came over, it's just monstrous that it changes our whole view. And they've, you know, finding that evidence to say, sorry, 1492?
Uh-uh. Well, I mean, they found stuff on Oak Island that goes back to the 10th century.
Probably the Nordic Scandinavian explorers.
Yeah, and they're
way
saying,
before the Vikings.
Do we know, did they relate to which part of Europe? Celtic? Were they more Germanic?
Well, it was in the area that the... oh, hell, I just went blank. I call it the senior moment.
I know.
What do I call it when I'm 36 and that happens?
Yeah, well, I happen to be 40 years older than you, so. the Knights Templar?
That's right. Yeah. There you go. Yeah, the Knights Templar, over a couple of centuries, apparently buried the treasure. Of course, there's so much going on in Europe, and you know they were the good guys, then the bad guys, then the good guys.
Well, a lot of the artifacts they found, they've analyzed the you know what they're made of and things like that, and they compare it to different mines across Europe, and they isolate it down to a specific area,
yeah,
which actually is part of the area where the Knights Templar were.
And some of the symbology carved into the rocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's awesome. Everybody, if you haven't checked out, you know, the Curse of Oak Island, it's just a curse only because the story was that so many people would have to die before the treasure would be found.
Six have died, and one more, and it'll reveal all its secrets.
Well, yeah.
I think we know what we have to do.
No. You know, it could be somebody dying of old age from a heart attack because everybody on this program.
Well, they've already had a couple of them.
Yeah.
You know, at old age.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but it is a fascinating story, and they are closing in on so much history, never mind the treasure. There's so much history to be found in that, you know, going back in time, and it rewrites our notion of, you know, traveling the world and, you know, how. No, everybody didn't just come over an inlet.
Well, I think it's also important to remember that history is an evolving thing. You know, it changes based on what we know. And I think we should take a lot of things with a grain of salt.
Yeah, but what also is serves the agenda. And listen, when I started school in 1960, it was already ingrained in me that Tibet was a part of China. But as I got a little older, Tibet had always been a part of China. But listen up, it was in that one summer, the summer before I even started school, that they rewrote all social studies textbooks. Because after 1955 is when China took over Tibet, slaughtered millions of monks to take over, and of course, shortly after that, you know, the Dalai Lama went into exile in India, and so on and so on. But it's whatever is the preference of the day for us to know about is what's taught. That may or may not be true.
Well, I'm gonna switch topics here real quick and tell you that I was talking to another friend of mine who she's a geneticist and big into shark research and so forth. But she was telling me that they had the study, and I looked it up. And the study was that August is the has the highest rate of shark attacks.
Oh.
And why? Coincidentally,
maybe the warm water.
I don't know. This is shark attacks worldwide, and it peaks way up during August. Well, the theory was this: what caused that? Well, they found that also August sells the most ice cream.
What?
Yeah. So the question is: does ice cream cause shark attacks?
I don't think we know that it does.
Well,
I think maybe people are going to the beach mostly in August.
I said, well, maybe so, but I want to know what flavor.
You know what? I kid you not, an hour has gone by so fast, but
it really has.
I can't tell you how much we appreciate you, Dr. Mike. It's just an awesome discussion, and maybe in a couple of months you come back and talk to us again.
I mean, we really scratched the surface. The question came to mind how whales and other mammal species that exist in the ocean even got back into the ocean. But Dr. Vicky, you're right. It has been a whole hour, and it's been a fascinating talk.
I just looked at the clock.
Oh, it's been fabulous. And thank
sorry
you
to
much.
All the ones that wanted a card.
No, we knew that. Everybody knows when we have a guest, it's not likely we're going to draw cards. So Michael and I have less to talk about than we can draw cards when we're on together. But Dr. Mike, I want to congratulate you on your retirement. Well deserved.
Thank you.
And congratulations to you and your wife on your 50th wedding anniversary.
Well, maybe we'll go another one or two.
Oh, I think
I expect at least another 50.
Yeah,
that's
well, okay.
Awesome. And thanks to everybody in the chat who's been, you know, for those who join us in the archives, try to join us live, because we know that they're archive listeners. And if you ever get a chance to join us live, we got quite the group here, and there's always some amazing chatter going on. And now and again, we have special guests like Dr. Wendy, Dr. Mike, you know, and Dr. Tabitha, and a few others. And I see that a couple of people have bought Tabitha's recent book and are enjoying it very much. And, you know, that's what we're about here. And it's just to share information and what we're learning, growing, you know, and awesome.
It's a wonderful community. And when you join us live, you get to hear all the fun stuff that we edit out for the archives. So,
no, that's before and after the show. No swearing.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. But no, absolutely. I second that. I love the community that we have together. And I look forward to catching up with people every week. So absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
But, you know, yeah, it's come to that time of the evening, and Dr. Mike, definitely hope we can get you back on again. Always love these discussions. Yeah. And, again, we just scratched the surface. So many things we can talk about, but, yeah. You know, we didn't even get to Star Trek 4 tonight.
I learned a few things. I think this is the matriarch and the languages and the, you know, the intelligence that it takes, and, you know, Vegas is a hoax.
Yeah,
all of it.
That's yeah, great.
It's unfortunate that, you know, that things like that. There's a we're running out of time. That's another story.
Yeah,
that's something to look forward to for the next discussion.
Sure,
but
for sure.
Well, again, wonderful discussion. Kind of as we close out the evening, a thank you again, Dr. Mike, Dr. Vicky. Always an absolute pleasure. And any last thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just want to thank Mike. I appreciate you, and I appreciate everybody in the chat and the archives. And I love doing this show every Wednesday.
As do I. As do I. We missed last week. Like I said, I was selfish.
But you had a great holiday.
I did. But I missed catching up with you guys. So I absolutely love it. Well, we look forward to having you again. Dr. Mike, we're going to have you on the broadcast again. We'll pay you as much as you need, whatever your agent sends us. You got it. And look forward to seeing everybody next week. Until then, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.